Kia ora koutou. My name is Jennifer Curtin and I'm the Director of the Public Policy Institute here at the University of Auckland. In this policy pod, we are talking to Professor Michael Orsini. Michael's Professor at Feminist and Gender Studies Institute and Political Studies at the University of Ottawa in Canada, and he's here visiting the University of Auckland. Today we're going to be talking about emotions and feelings in politics and policy and how these are connected. So Michael, what got you interested in researching emotions in this way?
I started doing work on autism, actually, as a social science researcher, as a person interested in public policy. And when I started researching about autism, it became clear to me that emotions were everywhere in that discussion, debate, literature. And what I think drew me to that within autism and then sort of later as somebody interested in public policy was that there was this kind of contradictory role, like emotions, the lack of emotion is what was so prominent in thinking about autism and autistic people. But at the same time, people who engaged politically with autism were seen as too emotional. You know, so women, mothers were overly emotional and autistic people were not emotional enough, had this like disorder of affect is what the way people talked about it. So then as somebody interested in critical public policy, I wanted to think more about what are some approaches to understanding policy that are that challenge kind of the status quo. And so that kind of was an entry point for me. That's how I think research happens for a lot of folks. You don't plan to study that. You just kind of happen upon it through a series of circumstances.
It sits quite at, you can see the critical dimension coming through your work in the sense that when we teach students policy studies, we're often teaching them this policy cycle that we're all rational actors, that bureaucrats put aside their emotions and put aside their sense of where they sit on feelings and just follow some kind of rational decision-making process. So your work really speaks to the messiness of that, perhaps.
Yeah, I am interested in messiness, and I think, because I think that's the real world of policymaking. I think the constellation of actors who kind of circulate in those spaces, the issues that we're sort of called to address are sort of emerging. We don't know much about them. So how is it possible to think about that in any kind of way that would be called rational within sort of public policy? The idea that there are these neat stages of policymaking, the idea that the evidence is there for policymakers to digest and sort of come up with the best plans to respond to a problem. I don't think that describes the real world. And I think so part of what I've tried to push back against is this idea that we need to bracket emotions. And I don't think we can do that. I think we need to think with versus make a consistent effort, like some people do, to sort of really restrain and constrain the role that emotions play in policymaking. I don't think that gets us anywhere.
So you talk about your own interest in how there are different orderings of emotions and how these are managed in policy environments. Could you explain in layperson's terms what you mean by that?
Sure. I think I've been influenced by the work of some sociologists and one in particular who talks about this idea of feeling rules. And by that, she tries to sort of suggest that we have to sort of look at when and how certain emotions matter in our political world, in policymaking. So it's not just that it happens to be this emotion emerging. It means that there are other things happening at the level of our political world in terms of policy debates, broader issues, broader societal trends that lead us to say that these types of emotions are okay to express. But it also gets us beyond this. One of my pet peeves is like, is the idea that there are good emotions and bad emotions, and that there are certain feelings that should be expressed and others that shouldn't be expressed. And I think we can see that in many ways, something like anger can be really legitimate as an emotion to express in relation to a whole host of problems. Think about climate change, think about issues, domestic violence, and these kinds of issues where We can't say definitively that anger is an emotion we want to suppress, right?
Right.
So this kind of ordering, this helps me to think about how we can study this and say, what happens over time to allow certain actors to express themselves in certain kinds of ways? What allows political actors to express emotions in certain kinds of ways? And what are the investments we make in trying to manage what is really quite difficult to manage, right? Because emotions are so unpredictable.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think that political leaders in particular, it seems to be sometimes okay for them to, for example, cry. Mm-hmm. Particularly male politicians, it's become sort mm-hmm. of a something legitimate to demonstrate that they have a full suite of emotional capability, whereas it's not really evident that if, say, a woman political leader were to cry mm-hmm. over something, mm-hmm. Whether that would be still seen as her expressing a full suite of emotions mm-hmm. or whether that mm-hmm. would be seen as a weakness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, and I think that's a really good question. And it also sort of, for me as a researcher, means that thinking about emotions means we have to be also attuned to how those emotions are produced in a particular cultural context, and gender matters significantly, race matters significantly. Lots of Black folks and racialized folks have always been called out for being angry, mm-hmm. as if it's not appropriate for them to be angry, and there are legitimate reasons to be angry. And I think the idea that men crying is somehow gives you a broader sense of how they are feeling actors, again, pushes at this idea that we have very strong divisions when it comes to who can express themselves in particular kinds of ways. So why is it so cute when a man cries and so problematic when a woman cries? Because it feeds into a feminized stereotype that we thought we had kind of cast aside, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So picking up on that context issue, which is really interesting, and the question of race. Mm. You've done some interesting work on the dangerous offenders policy in Canada, mm-hmm. and also how emotions and the emotion of remorse in particular mm-hmm. plays out in a racialized way mm-hmm. in that context. Could you explain a little bit about that to us?
Yeah, this is preliminary work I've been doing with a Canadian scholar, Linda Mussel, who is doing her own interesting work around Indigenous issues kind of comparatively. But what it comes out of this work I've been doing as well, looking at different policy fields. But the key around dangerous offenders in Canada is that the decision to designate someone a dangerous offender is a serious one because it carries with it all kinds of really punitive measures. And it's a grave kind of designation for anyone. And what we found in sort of looking through some of the, even the media sort of around some of these cases, is that Indigenous people are overrepresented among our prisoner population, but also among people labeled dangerous offenders. So we were specifically interested in the expression of remorse because in many of these cases, the ability to express remorse to a judge can be really fundamental in the decision to designate someone a dangerous offender or not. And what's happened, I think, in many cases, Indigenous scholars have helped us in thinking about this, is that Indigenous people, not only Indigenous people, but there are some challenges in expressing remorse for all kinds of cultural reasons. Not because someone is not remorseful necessarily, but because remorse is read through a particular kind of lens. And it's not surprising that white people are really good at expressing remorse. And that doesn't mean, or performing remorse, that doesn't mean that they're actually remorseful. It means that through our own filter and cultural lens, we read them, they're legible as expressing remorse. So it's not just an academic point, because if you are not successful in expressing remorse, you can be labeled a dangerous offender. Mm. And so we're trying to think about culturally, what is an appropriate way of thinking about remorse that takes into consideration trauma, intergenerational trauma, and the legacy of colonialism that Indigenous people have experienced in Canada, that might explain what seems as this inability to perform a particular kind of emotional to express themselves, yourselves in an emotional way. So we've been, it's a challenging area, I think, because one doesn't sort of want to make sweeping generalizations about Indigenous people versus non-Indigenous people. But it is interesting also because remorse is what people call a retractive emotion, where people who are expressing it try to distance themselves from what happened, from an offense, or in this mm-hmm. case. But scholars also say that remorse is the least understood of emotions. On the other hand, in the popular kind of culture, we seem to think we have an ability to sort of sniff out people who are authentic and people who are faking it. Mm. So how do we have this kind of situation in which it's so poorly understood? At the same time, we all seem to think we have got this ability, this innate ability to figure out who is authentic and who is not authentic.
That's interesting to pull it back to politics for mm-hmm. a moment. So mm-hmm. Canada had an election last mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. We in New Zealand have one this year in mm-hmm. 2020. Mm-hmm. And we have a prime minister who's expressed a lot of a sense of feelings around kindness mm-hmm. and a need to bring a different kind of perspective or rhetoric to bear. So in a sense, kindness can be thought of as an emotional response. And mm-hmm. perhaps people often talk about voters making irrational decisions. And so those who go after politicians who might use a language of kindness might see that as an irrational approach. So... Mm-hmm. So we think about it as people voting for parties on the basis of an emotional response rather than, I'm going to put it in scare quotes, mm-hmm. factual mm-hmm. evidence, mm-hmm. as if somehow these two can be separated. And the latter, if they don't rely on fact, it's a bad thing. And yet the politics of kindness works on the idea of human compassion mm-hmm. and something that we feel. Mm-hmm. So how do we reconcile or unpick this, I suppose, a conundrum, really, mm. that we would expect voters to behave rationally, but we know for a fact, scare quotes again, mm-hmm. that there's emotion in there as well.
I think the first answer would be that we can't shy away from that dilemma in some senses. And the idea that we can have a world in which that is driven by emotion versus one that is driven by cold, hard facts is a false dichotomy. I think and part of my starting point for me is that if you reason with emotion, then you can say it's appropriate for folks to make decisions, political decisions based on evidence, for instance, around public health and affecting marginalized people or what have you. But you can still, there's still a place for an approach that is rooted in kindness and compassion, using evidence as a guide. So I guess that for me, the idea that we would not want, or we would try to move away from the idea that emotions don't matter, I think that's also problematic. On the other hand, you know, there also is, you know, a really strong gendered component about mm-hmm. who is expressing those particular emotions. And I think I don't claim to be an expert on what's happening in this particular place, but it's something obviously that your prime minister has experienced. When your prime minister behaves in a particular kind of way or is critical or uses strong language to condemn the Australian prime minister, there is pushback because it seems to be a departure from her previous stance. And that's just silly. The idea that one can't be strong, use strong language, be firm about issues, but also sort of come from a place of kindness and compassion, that's not incompatible. Mm. But I think in our shorthand, and the way we want to think about politics, it's much easier to seize on those particular kinds of moments. And the media sort of is only too happy to play into that as well.
And I'm sure, you know, those of us who work in survey research mm-hmm. and electoral behavior yeah. and wanting to quantify mm-hmm. things, we work off existing scholarship that teaches us to think about, you know, the rational economic voter, if mm-hmm. you like. Mm-hmm. So as if somehow, you know, being materially poor mm-hmm. is not an emotional, you know, that there aren't emotional responses mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Thinking about your own area of current research mm. and your focus on obesity in particular, you talk about policy interventions involving stigmatized populations about whom particular emotions might be attached. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I've been interested in the case of obesity, and I use that in scare quotes partly because it's a highly contested term within, I don't know if it is so much in New Zealand, but it certainly is in Canada. And I guess the starting point in this work is about how, what some people might call the emotionalization of policy, in the sense that how do we use, how do policies and programs reflect or target particular populations in which, and they become almost, it almost becomes legitimate to feel particular ways about these populations. And I think obesity is an interesting case in that there are strong, strong, deep-seated feelings we have as a society about fat. People don't want to use the term fat. It's kind of an explosive term, whereas when I've been doing work looking at talking to activists, they reclaim the term and they oppose very, very violently and strongly the language of obesity. So it's such an affective environment, right? Where different words have a lot of power and meaning. So my research has been trying to sort of think about that in the context of debates about shame and how can policies kind of work against or challenge fat shaming that happens? Can programs do that? But also sort of saying that as a field itself, which is highly influenced by a lot of research and science, talking to researchers and policymakers, they're also feeling actors. You know, they also and we always talk about the people on the outside of policymaking, on the outside who have strong feelings, but so do policymakers, so do researchers and scientists who are committed to evidence. So that's been interesting to sort of explore, like researchers talking about their own feelings about the particular research they're doing.
So one of the really, let me say, popular emotions, that politicians like to utilize, perhaps, particularly in more recent years, but it's not new, which is sort of the language of fear and of crisis. And we've noticed more recently, I think, around the world, not so much here and perhaps not so much in Canada, but in countries that are experiencing far-right radical right parties, drawing on emotions and trying to use emotion, drum up fear amongst voters. And so how do you think, as a small country in the South Pacific, Aotearoa New Zealand can best counter the rise of populism and policies that are based on sort of a fear of other or hate or anxiety or division, like an us then, because we know that politicians have this capacity to whip up that kind of emotional. So what would you say to us in advance of perhaps the next election, or how we think about that politics of fear or emotions of fear that politicians can end up, you know, provoking?
Yeah, a big question. I think it's quite clear that the far right in a number of countries have been very successful in mobilizing, using all kinds of tools to mobilize hate, and they've been successful in the way that progressive forces have not. So emotions don't, in some way, the fact that these emotions are attached to misogyny, racism, and all the things that that we are, I mean, I personally I'm abhorred by. Is not insignificant. It's part of that. It's a big part of that discussion. But I think I would start with some of the work that Arlie Hochschild has done on in a recent book, "Strangers in Their Own Land," where she connects this idea of what she calls a deep story, and it's an interesting idea, because what she did was she went in and talked to a lot of folks. She's a progressive, lefty sociologist and you know, living in Berkeley, California. And she decided to visit with folks who would support Trump supporters or Tea Party supporters in the U.S. And she talks about a deep story as one way of understanding that what drives folks and their unequivocal support for, in this case, the president, and what seems to be incongruous with their own economic needs and socioeconomic needs is this idea of a deep story, the fact that people connect with a narrative that feels right to them. This deep story doesn't have to be, she says, concerned with facts. It works actively to sort of resist facts. I think there's interesting work there, but there's something powerful in this idea that I'm not trying to legitimize or rationalize forms of hatred or racism, but it does mean that countering hate, countering division requires real efforts to help others to depart from this narrative that makes sense to them. Mm. And I say that, again, it's not about legitimizing the racism, but that what really happens is that it's very difficult for people to sort of move outside of a narrative that feels right to them. It doesn't have to be, you can counter them with evidence or facts, and that will not work. Mm. So I think that that's the kind of insight. It doesn't necessarily provide us with a magic bullet or an easy solution. But what she discovered in doing this research was that part of what she had to do was try to understand where folks were coming from versus kind of a knee-jerk response to suggest that this is abhorrent behavior and we need to resist it and challenge it with all our might.
So no silver bullets for the left in New Zealand even the centre, the moderate centre that's seeking to avoid, the populist sentiment mm-hmm. coming into play.
Mm.
Interesting place to end.
Yes, unfortunately. I'm sorry.
So thank you very much, Michael, for giving us your time today. And we look forward to seeing the research that comes out of your four policy fields.
Thanks for the opportunity.